يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series taking a close look at the Middle East, North Africa region. Hello and welcome to Middle East Analysis. Now, the topic that we're focusing on is Libya. We haven't really talked about Libya for a long time. Monumental piece of news, really, was the abduction of the Prime Minister, Ali Zeidan. He has subsequently been released, but it's a topic that's going to kickstart this particular cast with Dr. Harry Hagopian. Dr. Harry Hagopian, how are you?
Hello, James. It's a pleasure being with you. And this is quite an interesting room we're in because I'm used to your little studio. And this actually makes it more real because there's noise, there are people moving around the building. So we're not insulated in a soundproof studio like yours, but we're in a more real world kind of place. And yes, it's fun to be here. And yes, you are absolutely right. The key story, as far as I'm concerned, for these couple of days has been and still is Libya and the abduction of the Prime Minister Ali Zeidan by militias and his subsequent release a few hours later.
Now, we've talked on many occasions about Colonel Gaddafi and subsequently, obviously, what happened to him. We've seen the instability in the country. We then haven't spoken for a number of months in detail about Libya. Now we have this mishmash of politics, the country trying to establish itself in a new era. We see the militia and their hand in this. I want to know where that crossover is between the army, the militia, what's going on politically. So in light of that abduction and release of the Prime Minister, give us a bit of context with Libya right now.
That's very interesting, James, because the question that you've asked, or the number of questions that you've actually asked in that one question, is something that everybody, all political analysts and pundits, have been trying to talk about for months and months, and certainly for the past 24, 48 hours as a result of this abduction. Let us remind our listeners and viewers that this abduction, people ask, why do you abduct, why do you kidnap the Prime Minister, particularly one who was living very visibly in Tripoli, the capital of Libya, in a hotel? So he wasn't actually hiding in a very securely guarded building. Well, there are many theories, but the one I probably would go for at the moment is that he was abducted by militias who were angered by the fact that US commandos actually came into Libya and captured Anasir Libi, who is purportedly an Al-Qaeda suspect. And this was a reaction by some of the militias in Libya to that capture and the fact that they considered this as an encroachment upon the sovereignty of Libya as a country. Now, interestingly enough, this little event also encapsulates some of the problems within Libya. Now, one of the things about Libya is that it's a small population of around 6+ million people. It is extremely an oil-rich country, which had for years and years and decades been run by a brutal dictator, Muammar al-Qaddafi. Now he's not there. As a consequence of that, and as a consequence of the fact that we, through NATO, helped liberate, between inverted commas, Libya, where do we stand now? Well, where we stand now is not a million miles away from where the rest of the Middle East, North Africa region stands, in the sense that there is confusion, there is chaos, there is uncertainty and lack of clarity, actually, as to what's happening. Each country is, of course, specific to its own. In Egypt, the issues are different from Syria. In Syria, they're different from Yemen, from Tunisia, and certainly from Libya. In Libya at the moment, I think the biggest threat to the stability of Libya is the fact that there are hundreds upon hundreds of different armed groups or militias with lots of arms at their disposal, going around trying to apply their own rule and their own laws in the country. And that symptomatizes to me a very clear point, which is that at the moment, Libya is not run by a fully trained, fully cohesive army or police force, but by different militias from different parts of this country.
I would ask now, well, how do you control those elements? How do you control the tribes? Because when Gaddafi was clinging on to power, that was his argument, wasn't it? Well, if you get rid of me, there's no one else that will be able to control all these factions. Was he right?
Not only Gaddafi himself, but his son, Saif al-Islam, also said the same thing. He warned over and over again that if you topple my father's rule, then you're going to get a fragmented, fractured, and therefore extremely chaotic Libya. I don't subscribe to that doom and gloom theory, just as I have consistently and very stubbornly, you might say, opposed the idea that the Middle East, North Africa, so-called Arab Spring is over, that we are in the autumn of those uprisings, and that the whole awakening has failed. It hasn't failed. Transitions, like revolutions, take a lot of time. People today are very short of patience. If we look at history, revolutions and transitions have taken decades before they've actually taken root, before they put down roots. We are only talking, at best, 3 years of uprisings across a massively huge, large area of the Middle East, North Africa. It is going to take time. And what needs to be done in Libya is to try and consolidate those militias into a regular army and into a regular police force that would then disarm those militias, each one doing their own thing, and then constitute a proper army and a proper police force. Let me give you two examples, for instance, about this, James. Misrata, for instance, is one town in Libya which has suffered most. Zintan is a place where Saif al-Islam, the son of Colonel Gaddafi, is still held in custody. Now, those two places are almost also like Tripoli, like Benghazi, like other areas. They have their own militias defending them. Misrata says, we have suffered most, so we should have a word in what happens in Libya. Zintan says, no, we're going to keep Saif al-Islam in custody. The whole idea of what the rule of law is and how international human rights works hasn't yet sunk in with Libyans, and I don't blame them, because it's only been since 2011 they've woken up to a reality that is totally different from the brutal dictatorship to which they were used to.
I want to talk about the population as a whole, ordinary Libyans in inverted commas, and I also want to talk about minority groups, which I'll come to as my concluding question. So the people of Libya, no more Gaddafi. As you say, we need to be more patient. We need to understand this is a process that doesn't happen overnight. Are they better off? And if so, why are they better off?
In my opinion, they are better off. And it's very simple. And it's going to sound a little bit cheesy. It's going to sound a little bit too abstract. But for me, any people who are released of the yoke of oppression, released of the yoke of suppression, is always a good thing. These uprisings, these movements across the whole Middle East, North Africa, painful as they are, difficult as they are, bloody as they are, violent as they are, murderous as they are also hopeful signs for the future, because we are working toward a phase where eventually, hopefully, and I cannot say we will get there tomorrow or we will even get there, but hopefully the idea is to get to a place where the dignity of every human being, the citizenship of every human being with all the rights that that word entails, are secure and become secure, so it is no longer a top-down governance or rule, whereas one man, and it's always a man in the Middle East, North Africa, decides and everybody else has to lie down and say, yes sir, no sir, thank you sir. This is what those uprisings are aspiring for. And in Libya, there's also a very interesting thing, which is that Libya is drenched with oil. And yet at the moment, given the confusion, given the chaos, given the fact that we haven't managed yet to train enough of those militias to constitute an army and a police force, this oil-rich country is importing oil rather than exporting it and becoming one of those rich countries that would actually be able to move forward. But that is my hope. That is where it will go. That is where it will hopefully go. And with it, the rest of the Middle East, North Africa, all the brutality and violence notwithstanding. Call me naive, but I'm a man of faith as much as a man of political analysis. And if I do not clutch to that sign of hope, then I might as well not be sitting here with you today.
And just lastly, Harry, there are victims on the road of transition to stability and peace. We know that. We know that in Syria. We know that throughout the Middle East, North Africa region, as you've said. Is this Libya, that is, another example of a country where there's still widespread oppression of minorities? Obviously, I'm thinking somewhat the Christian minorities in the country. What's their plight right now?
Interestingly enough, the issue of minorities, and when we talk about minorities, a word that I'm hesitant to use, as you well know, we often then, from minorities, do a leap and go into Christian communities, because in the back of our minds, minorities means Christians across the Middle East, North Africa. That is not entirely true, as Syria, as Iraq, and as other countries would prove. However, in the context of Libya, James, which is what we're talking about, it's a small country with a sparse population of just over 6 million. We actually do have small Christian communities. Now, a lot of our listeners might be surprised, because when I say Christians in Israel, Palestine, when I say Christians in Jordan, when I say Christians in Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, people say, yes, I've heard about those. Those are the indigenous, largely Arab Christians, which are of the region, from the region, born there, bred there, have as much right as anybody else to be there and enjoy the citizenship of those parts of the world. However, when you talk about Libya, people would say, what? Christians in Libya? There are actually, and roughly I would say, and forgive me, but you know as well as I do that statistics are not something that is very clear in the Middle East. Everybody basically spins statistics in the way that suits their own purposes. But I would say academically that there are roughly about 500,000 Christians in Libya. The majority of them are Coptic Orthodox Christians, because the Copts have a history of presence in Libya and in North Africa. So I would say roughly about 300,000 maybe Copts are there. Then there are about roughly 140,000-150,000 Catholics, usually of Maltese or Italian-Libyan origins, because Libya was colonized by Italy in its history. And those, actually, the Catholics have also churches, as do the Orthodox churches, across the whole country, in places like Benghazi, in places like the capital in Tripoli. And the rest of this 500,000 figure that I actually shared with you would be other Christian communities. And interestingly enough, in Libya, unlike the confessionalism that, say, the regime or the jihadi groups are trying to foment in Syria and in Iraq, in Libya, the question is tribal and clannish. It's not sectarian or religious. And therefore, those Christian communities, we have an ambassador for the Vatican, for instance, in Libya. Those people are not targeted because they are Christian or because they're different from the overwhelming Sunni majority, but people are viewed more in terms of tribal loyalties. That's another good thing in terms of minority rights, but it's not a good thing in terms of the stability of the country as it purports to enter into a new phase.
Well, talking of new phases, that's definitely a watch this space. We've got a watching brief, haven't we, on many countries.
Absolutely.
In the Middle East, North Africa region. But for now, Dr. Harry Hagopian, international lawyer, consultant, and also general expert on the Middle East, North Africa region. Thanks very much for your time today.
James, there are so many experts on the Middle East, North Africa. They're coming out of every hole I can know of. What I try to do is to reflect in as much as possible with integrity what I believe in and what I know of the region. So it's a pleasure, as always, to be with you.